Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you so much for coming down. Really appreciate it. Insane in the Membrane podcast.
Insane in the Membrane is back for another live podcast recording on Sunday, the 23rd of February.
I found that through humour, people open up and we have a laugh, and I really appreciate you coming down and doing this.
This is an intimate live show with comedian Rich Wilson and very special surprise guest in front of a small audience at the Pleasance Islington. In fact, you are so close to the comedians, you could probably lick them.
We can have a laugh while we do it. I think that's what I'm trying to show with the podcast.
January's a struggle for us all, so put yourself something to look forward to in February. Insane in the Membrane live at the Pleasance, Sunday, Feb 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Just £5. Nearest tube, Caledonian Road, Piccadilly Line. Dead easy, no excuses.
You did great, Rich.
Thanks, Bob. You
did
as well.
You did great.
Thank you.
Click the link in the show description for this episode on your podcast app or go to pleasance.co.uk.
What do we do now?
I don't know. I think that's it. Thanks for coming. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
Happy New Year, everybody. And I imagine your New Year's resolutions have already fallen by the wayside, as have mine. Hope you had a good Christmas, hope you had a good New Year. Hope you're recovering nicely and getting ready for 2020. Oh, yeah. This week's episode, Paul and I went to James Acaster's home to have a chat with him just before he was about to leave for his sellout UK tour. His bags were packed in the passageway as we were doing it, and James has gone on to just absolutely smash it. The tour has just gone absolutely nuts. I was lucky enough to see him at Earth in Hackney a little while ago, and the show is absolutely superb. If you do get a chance to see it, which I don't think you will, because it's sold out and gone, but if you see it anywhere like on Netflix or something like that, do see it, because it's a great show. We had to hold this one back because we did it at the beginning of just before his sellout tour. We had to hold it back because there's a few spoilers in the show, so we didn't want to give anything away, so we waited till now. But what a gift for the new year, ladies, gents, everyone. James Acaster.
We measured it actually, and it was like, yeah, you fucking should have, but now they can't get it in, you're wasting these guys' time. And then those came in and they put it in, and they went, there you go. And they went, when did you have this measured? And I was like, oh, what? A few months ago, I was measured it all up. And they went, oh, good job. And then they went, and I had a photo of it there, and he was like, fuck you.
You wanker.
He was so angry about it. I was like,
very spatially aware, James. You just knew it.
I looked at him and just knew that'll fit.
But Jade and I, with our sofa, we went out to Asda to buy... just to get tea bags, actually.
Mm.
And then DFS happened to be next door.
Yeah.
And we just moved into our flat in where the one you've been to. And then we just have a look. And as we walked in, there was this shiny blue, very jade sofa. And it was like, all right, well, and then suddenly we'd ordered it. And we didn't measure ours either.
Yeah.
But luckily it came in two bits. And
I really loved putting that flat together. Like, I mean, I'm looking forward to like doing these other rooms because like it is so much fun. I love like going around like buying that clock. I was excited when I saw that clock. Like, that got so good in the living room. And like, just like thinking about all of it. I never thought I'd give a shit about any of that. And,
but then it becomes, well, it's your place.
Yeah. Well, it's not with anything, like, yeah, I mean, it's probably another mental health related thing, isn't it? But like, yeah, just making you feel like you're your own place, especially when you do our job.
Absolutely.
You constantly feel like you don't have a home for years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was always influenced by the people that I was living with. They always seemed to be more in charge with the surroundings than I was.
Yeah.
And so I never really had much say. This has been the first time where I've put my stamp on it. Mm. And actually, I want it to be more. So there's books that I look at where these guys, their whole lifestyle, is not just the things they wear, but the places that they live in and what they've got. Like very much like this. This is very stylish, James. I'm always...
Thank you, mate.
This is what I like about you. You have a coolness about you, which I know sort of goes against...
Do I?
Yeah. Your poster.
I've never said that before.
Mate, I'm telling you, the poster for your latest show, Paul Desani with the glasses. And I'm going to get that and I want it on the wall because I think it's so cool. It's really cool. You do have a, even though you come across as a bit, not geeky and nerdy, they're not the right words, but.
I'd probably use those words.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean?
Awkward.
But you do have a coolness. You have a style, like the way you dress. Yeah.
I think, I don't know. I think that's just, that's very kind of you to say. You're cooler than me. Like in terms of like, you know, like categorically cool.
Well, I think I'm more like paint by numbers cool. Like people go, like certain things, they go, of course, yeah, he's cool. He wears a scarf.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas yours is more, yours is proper cool because you don't see it coming. And it's like,
I think we both work with what we've got.
I think so.
That's all you can do, right? In order to be cool or yourself comfortably, you've got to go, this is who I am, and lean into that a bit more. Or just like, what I like, love doing. Because for ages, all I did was, I didn't even think about what I wore.
No.
For like most of, like until I was in my mid to late 20s, probably my late 20s.
Yeah.
Actually, no, because I started, like, when I started doing comedy, I started wearing all the jumpers and the slacks and, like,
there was,
like that.
It was actually, you actually thought about it.
That's what, you know, audiences don't know who you are.
Yeah.
So before you get to the mic, they need a bit of a flag up as to, like, what they're going to expect.
Yes.
Because, like, and so I'd, like, dress like that, and then they would, like, expect the kind of comedy I was going to do. Because I didn't have much money, I just wore that all the time.
Right.
And I didn't want to.
No.
So off stage, I was dressed like that all the time. I'm like, and some days, you know, I remember like some other comics would be like, the fuck are you still dressed like that for? You're not on stage right now.
Well, we were in New Zealand. And yeah. We went to, is it, what's the island with the volcano?
Yeah,
and
Waiheke. Yeah.
And we climbed to the top of the volcano and then we got back and then you went on stage with the same stuff.
Even
the shoes.
Yeah, you know? Climbing the fucking volcano with like, you know,
it broke.
Clark's shoes and like an M&S jumper and all this kind of stuff and like school, you know, proper like, you know, some geeky slacks and then just going on stage just like that. But like, yeah, and then I made a conscious decision after I was in 27 or something. Most changes in my life happened after a breakup. But
right.
Like, I was like 27 and just remember walking out of my flat to the tube one day and just looking down and going, I look stupid. And like really hating how I looked and then deliberately trying to dress differently. Not cool, but just differently. I was like, I just don't want to wear this anymore.
Yeah.
But then I got into another uniform. So it's like, I think there's like, so then I got into like, I wear cords now. So I wear like, you know, so at that point I was like, I'm just wearing cords. So I was always wearing slacks and now I'm just wearing cords. And now I'll like buy shirts instead of jumpers and like, they'll be like, you know, plaid or like, you know, checked or whatever. And like, I went through a phase of that, but like shopping at places like Top Man and stuff. Cause I was like, but it's amazing how that was like, also like around that part of my life, it was, I remember going to the, like I became a massive hypochondriac again. So
right.
I hadn't been for a while.
As it comes and goes, is it?
It comes and goes with anxiety and just like whatever it is. So
yeah.
Like, you know, going, ah, so like come out of a relationship. All I could think of come out of that relationship was everything that was wrong with me and everything I didn't like about myself.
Yeah.
So then it was just like, I remember going to the doctors and being like, oh, I got this like dry skin on my face here. Yeah. Like, you know, either side. And they were like, do you moisturize? And or do you like, wash your face in at night. I was like, no. They're like, well, you can't go and do that, mate. Like, you got to wash your face with some, get a face wash and get a moisturiser. So it's like, I might as well be going to Jonathan Van Ness. It wasn't like, you know, like I wasn't going to a doctor. And they're like, you should just do those things. And like, and so I started doing that and actually going to like, and like paying a little bit more for a haircut,
yeah,
and stuff
yeah,
like that,
yeah, yeah.
And then asking the hairdresser, like, "What do you put in your?" Like actually going, oh, "Okay," and doing stuff like that. And then, like, I had it again recently where, like, I had this, like, rash come up on my face and went to the doctor and she was like, did you use aftershave? I was like, no. She's like, well, you do that. And I was like, and I told my girlfriend about it. She was like, is that how it happens? Every time you go to the doctor, they just give you like manscaped advice. Like it's not, you're not ill.
You're just looking after yourself. It's like stuff grooming.
That most people do. Yeah. But like, yeah, but I had that massive like, yeah. And then recently I've kind of had it again. After I finished those, filmed those four shows.
Yeah.
And that was all like wearing corduroy and all of them and all terminal colours. And I had a big thing after that of being like, right, now I'm going to look for more like colourful outfits.
Yes, yeah,
deliberately.
Yeah.
Anything I've bought since then has been almost deliberately what I wouldn't normally wear. And like on the episodes of Taskmaster that are in the studio, I've deliberately chosen really bright colours. And that poster you're talking about is like they basically that. Basically, goes, just,
yeah.
What's the opposite that I would ever wear ever? And then wearing a like sunset jacket and stuff.
But you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. Most people. It would look contrived and it would look like you've just said, I went out of my way to go to the opposite of what I was doing. But it doesn't look like that. You've got this really good eye for style, which I know has never been said to you, probably.
Yeah, it's been said to me. And if any of my mates hear this, though, I'll make fun of me so bad.
But, yeah, and you look at them. But I am telling you, as a man that knows, you have style. And, well, I look around, mate, and you have. It's brilliant.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's enviable as well. I was always, I was in the mod thing, so I was a mod for years.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all very, I got so fed up because it's very short-sighted.
Yeah.
You have to be a certain way and you have to listen to certain things. And when I'm not like that, I'm a bit of everything. This is why people talk about cultural appropriation at the moment. Yeah. I'm like, no, we need a bit of that. We need a bit of that, you know, mix it up. You know, I mean, obviously, if you're doing it and stealing it or whatever, but be influenced by different things.
Sure.
For sure.
There's differences.
Yeah. But it's effortless with you. And that really fucks me off.
Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, probably talk about cultural appropriation. I think my worst look I ever did was when I was a teenager. And I bought like a proper kind of Rastafarian kind of hoodie at a festival because I loved it. I didn't understand anything about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I knew it was wrong still. I remember wearing it, looking in the mirror and going, something's not right about this. And when I grew up and learned about cultural appropriation, I was like, that's it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
it, actually. That wasn't mine to wear. And I shouldn't have been doing it. Yeah, this suddenly made sense. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. I knew it.
But, did it have dreadlocks in the hood, like when you put the hood up?
Yeah. There should have. No, there wasn't. But, like, God, if there was, I'd be... I mean, so many things where I'm just so glad that social media didn't exist when I was younger. And there might be a photo of me on MySpace somewhere with that hoodie on.
Wow.
And I'd really, probably go to great lengths to seek that out and destroy it.
I was going
to
say, someone's probably going to look for that right now.
Yeah, now it's just going to come back and haunt me. That'll be it.
But this, I grew up, my dad was never, it was never one for, you know, he'd shave and he'd have get his hair cut in a normal way, but there was never anybody around to teach me about grooming and things like that. It was only from my first proper girlfriend, Zena, that she said, yeah, you can't dress like this anymore. I had a pair of jeans that I tried to bleach, but I ended up just tipping bleach down the back of them.
Great. So just look like you had some sort of accident. Yeah,
which I told people I had. I went, oh yeah, I just dropped bleach in them. I'm like, why am I wearing them?
It is weird that kind of thing of like how you, because like definitely... I didn't really have any men in my life who were like, you know, you should make some effort. Look nice. And do, apologies to my dad who listens to every podcast that I ever do. But no, it'd be like, you should dress up more. You should do, take care of how you look. You know, get yourself a nice haircut. This looks good on you. This doesn't, and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of like definitely grew up thinking like, if you took care of how you looked, you were arrogant.
Yeah, and definitely.
It was like a bad thing, and you were vain, and don't do that. And so for years, it was just like not doing. And then I remember when I mentioned Van Ness earlier, but I remember seeing the first, the original like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Yeah,
it was on TV, and kind of having a negative reaction to it because I felt like, oh, it's like saying people aren't good enough the way they are.
You're right. Yeah.
It seems so bizarre to me now that I felt like that, but it was kind of like how I felt about, and I thought that taking care of yourself was any attention paid to yourself was bad.
Right.
It meant you were arrogant, you were vain, you were self-obsessed. So like, I saw people going to other people and going, you need to look better, you need to do this. It's like, but people should love me the way I am.
Yes.
And so I had this really negative reaction against it. And then, like, when the new series, when Queer Eye came out on Netflix, and everyone was going, oh, you got to watch it. And I was very resistant to it because I was like, no, because it's that thing of like, you know, when we're not good enough as we are, all this. And like, I watched it and then you kind of realise like, oh no, it's about thinking you are good enough. It's the exact opposite. It's like you actually saying to yourself, I am worth actually spending a bit of time on it. I am worth, like, you know, taking care of myself and all that. And that if you do that, you feel more worthy. And actually, if you don't, what I was doing before was kind of telling myself I wasn't worth that. Like, I'm not paying attention to how it looks. I think that's arrogant, and like, I shouldn't be arrogant because I'm not, you know, what do I think I'm better than everyone else, and I'm not better than everyone else, or this. And it's really fascinating, actually. I mean, I know there's, like, you know, people have got their problems with the Queer Eye guys in their, you know, their politics or whatever and all that stuff, but like, in terms of the show, it's amazing. Like, if we're talking about mental health, the amount that I found that to be helpful, in a way that, like, I know it sounds very basic, but like, it's just incredible how you watch a show like that and go, oh, actually, yeah, I never have thought. You see people who are like you on it and saying things that you've said, and when you hear it out of other people's mouths about themselves, you go, no, you shouldn't feel like that. No, actually, you know,
I have conversations with people, with blokes, about moisturiser a lot.
Yeah,
and it's something that I never grew up with, that, because growing up when I did, it was like, that was unheard of. Like,
yeah,
I even do it in my set where I talk about the cabinet that was in the bathroom. Was none of it was Dad's. It was like, there'd be a shaving brush and his shaving gear, but the rest was just weird lotions and potions that Mum had tried and all her bits and bobs. And so it's only been in the last sort of 5 years that I've really been going, oh, actually, like you said earlier, I do need a bit drier. And my hand's definitely dry. And I have conversations with builders and people are like, you've got to do that, mate. Moisturise, you split, hurts in the winter, mate. And it's really, it's nice. It's,
that's the thing, Builders know about it because that's because it's got so bad that they're splitting and bleeding. So it's like, okay, now I'll put some moisture. That's how bad we let it get as blokes. I have to be physically bleeding and I can't pick stuff up. It's like, okay, now I'll put moisturiser on because it's a medical thing. It's like a actual.
It's the same with mental as well, isn't it? You get to that point where you're just broken and bleeding and it takes someone else. Oh, mate, you've really got to sort yourself out. And then you go, yeah.
Yeah.
But we have to be at that point where we've...
Oh, I didn't go to I've been to therapy. Like, the first time I ever went to therapy was like in 2013, and it was when I was like, and I didn't know it at the time, but like, I was just like ridiculously anxious and like probably depressed as well, but like my anxiety was like insane. But I didn't think I had any problems with anxiety or anything, so I wasn't framing it as that. But like, I went to one therapy session and then like, and it was because like the relationship I was in at the time was kind of driving me nuts. And
yeah,
I was like,
yeah,
crazy thinking that like this person was going to leave me. And so I went to this therapy session and then I think we broke up later that day.
Wow.
It was like, I came back from it and I think that was like, she had been a bit like, this is probably gone too far. If he's going to therapy, I probably should send this relationship. So she did the right thing and did do that.
Oh, I thought you'd gone to therapy and then come back and go, right, out.
No. I think she was like, do you know what? He's maybe doing worse than I thought he was. And maybe we should just end this relationship. Because, like, you know, in a way, what I was mainly kind of like obsessing over was like thinking we were going to break up. And I think she was probably like, well, we are. And I should probably just do it now. And it was for the best, like made me feel a lot better. And I went to one more after that, but I was just like, I feel great now.
Yeah, of course.
And that's just, she was like, okay, well, you seem cool. And I was like, right, great. And then then I just thought, right, that was it. I just felt stressed because my relationship was bad. And that was, and so now and I don't need to go. I don't need to go anymore. And so I didn't go for ages. And then like, it was 2017 where like I had a breakdown, but actually acknowledged that it was that.
Right.
So like, you know, I think it definitely happened to me before, probably a couple of times, like once when I crashed my car when I was 18 and I wasn't okay for like 6 months.
Yeah, I heard that on the other, was it Adam Buxton's one?
Yeah, it might have been. I think I've talked about it on a few things.
Yeah, and that was, you were talking about the fact that you didn't think it had affected you.
No.
That much, but then in the evening, you suddenly would think about death and...
Oh, it was a thing of like, I had a whole day of just being like, having a laugh about it. I crashed my car, and whatever, with my friends. And then I remember just being alone in the house, and everyone else had gone out. I don't know, I can't remember what the rest of my family were doing, but it was just me on my own. And I was like washing this plate up in the sink and looked up at the window, which was right in front of the sink. It was just dark outside.
Yeah.
It was winter, and it was just my reflection, this black mirror. And I was like, oh. I didn't realise I think I was on the toilet when I actually sunk in. I think I did that, felt a bit down, then sat down on the toilet, and then went, I'm going to die one day. And it was
it's a mad one, isn't it, when you realise.
Yeah, I think I had moments like it before, but it was like properly sinking in of like, oh shit, I don't understand anything. Wow. I don't understand the world that I live in. I don't understand how life works. You know, am I just a bunch of like meat and chemicals, and like I'm not really me, I'm not really a person. Yeah. I'm just a bunch of stuff firing out different emotions and thoughts, but at the end of the day it's all gonna break one day, and then I'll just like be dead, and like that won't mean, you know, and then whoever was I anyway, and all this stuff. And then like, so it was 6 months of like, but I didn't think at any point during that I'm depressed or I'm anxious or anything like that.
No.
I was just like, and this is true as well, but I was just like, I had a car crash and now I can't stop thinking about this because that seems more important than anything else at the minute.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, why would I give a shit about making desserts in a kitchen for, you know, £3.50 an hour when I'm going to die one day? And why do I give a shit about this band I'm trying to get off the ground when no one will even remember I'll be dead? So like everything like seemed bigger like that. And but at the time I was still like vaguely, I was just starting to let go of religion at that point.
Right.
And so I was still, but then that kind of thing kicked in of like scared, and so reached back out for it again.
Yeah.
So I was talked to a vicar at one point, I talked to friend of the family who was this like very religious guy who like would talk to me about, you know, stuff like that. He gave me this book that I read that was just very comforting, just about Christianity, and it's like very comforting, like, you know, kind of modern day kind of preacher just talking, putting stuff in terms that I could understand and relate to, and that made me feel better for a while. And at that point I was so kind of like down and in a very dark place that I think I got to a point where I was just like, I don't even care if I learn the truth or not now, I just want to get out of this.
Yeah.
I just want to feel better. Whereas if at that point I thought a bit more about it in terms of mental health or whatever, then I probably would have got myself out of it in a much healthier, better way, in a way that would have sustained me longer and given me things that I could employ in my life and make me feel better. But I didn't, because I just saw it as, you know, the bare kind of, this is what happened, this is how I'm feeling, now I want to get out of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the same with like that breakup was just like really anxious all day long. I was just like, just the height of anxiety all day. I felt like my mind was like a beehive, and just and I was pacing. I could never sit still. I was pacing around. I was phoning my friends all the time. She said this the other day. Do you think that? And all this kind of stuff. And then when we broke up, and I was like, just relieved that I was right, almost.
Yeah.
Even if my anxiety and the way I was acting had caused the breakup, you know, I don't know, but like, you know. Because, you know, it's quite intense to be around.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, even if that was it, I was like, right, okay, I'm not crazy. She did want to break up with me. Okay, fine. And then feeling better about it and being like, okay, so that was all it was. Mm. And then so carrying on until like the next time you get hit again.
Yeah.
I pretty much felt like that. I think the end of most relationships, when like, as soon as like I could tell when they had lost interest, and instead of like dealing with it in a good way, I just go straight into anxiety of like, no, like, you know, this is going to end now, or am I imagining that it's going to end? Am I crazy? And all this kind of stuff. I'm just doubting myself. I remember once having to take myself out of I was in a girlfriend's flat, and she was getting ready to go out, and she was like in front of the mirror just sorting her hair out or whatever, and I came up behind her and put my arms around her, and she kind of instinctively kind of like pushed me away and said don't crowd me or something. And like, probably, like, you know, the relationship was like starting to come to an end. And that, I remember as soon as she did that, I remember kind of almost freezing like behind her, and then she went into the bathroom, and as soon as the door locked, I went out the flat. I just went down the stairs, out the flat, into the courtyard, and just started pacing around the whole courtyard and being like, just leave, just go home now. Wow. And when she gets out the bathroom, you just won't be there. And that'll be it. Yeah. Just go. And then I was like, you can't fucking do that. You look fucking insane. And then like went back in. And by the time she got out the bathroom, was stuck. She didn't even know I'd gone out.
She didn't even know that.
She didn't know that any of that had happened. I was sitting there, you're right. And then like, not, you know, pretending like nothing's wrong.
Yeah.
And like, so it was that for like years of like, you know.
Wow. But when it's out of your control, if you don't want it to end, it's out of your control, which is even worse. It's different if you're both kind of like, oh, I'm not feeling this. I'm not feeling this either, and it kind of peters out on its own. But if there's one of you still, no, this is cool, I love it. But that other person's the one that's not feeling it. That's horrible.
It is horrible, but at the same time, if like if I'm to reflect on it, like, you know, like they were right that the relationship wasn't good. We weren't very well suited to one another. But like, I was so kind of like, again, there's a bunch of stuff that I hadn't worked through at the time. Like, I just, if I was in a relationship, it was almost like, well, I've got to make this work. This has to work. But rather than kind of being like, oh, do you know what? We're not that well suited to each other, so we should just break up and that's fine.
Yeah.
And it's, and it doesn't mean that either of us are bad people or anything like that. It doesn't mean that, you know, I'm a dick. It just means that, like, you know, that's
just not working.
It's not working.
Yeah.
But instead I'd be like, no, you've got to work on it. You've got to make it work. You've got to, yeah. And I didn't want them to, so my self-worth was too tied up in the relationship. Right. And it shouldn't have been. I should have been like, no, if they don't want to be with me, fine.
Yeah.
But like, instead it was like, I it's like never really acknowledging it, putting it into words or whatever. I just thought that if you're in a relationship, you've got to make it work.
Exactly. Feel you've put enough work into it.
Yeah.
I know that. I've heard that before.
So yeah.
You've got to work at it. Let's work here. But if it's not working, and you shouldn't be together, chemistry's not there, and you're just papering over something that's...
And you don't realise until you're in one that works. Mm. Like now, I'm in easily the best relationship I've ever been in.
Right.
And it's just been easy from the start. And, like, and when you go, oh, this is how it should feel, and it's just it's completely different. And I realised, like, looking back, there are some things sometimes that I've called love in my life, and it's not been that.
But
I've mislabeled it. Some of, like, you know, actually anxiety and being like, oh, I love this person because when I'm around them, you know, it just feels like so. All my emotions are so sky high. There's all this, and then you look back and go, "Oh, I was anxious," and I was like, "They made me like really anxious,
they put me on edge,
and worried, and scared, and like, you know, depressed, or not like, and all those things." And going, "That wasn't being in love. I was a mess." And like, but that's because, like, you know, the first relationship I was ever in was like when I was 21. My first, like, saying I loved someone. I had girlfriends before that were like, you know, I think I have a few months at a time or whatever. But I had this really intense, short relationship when I was 21, and it was just like completely tied up in anxiety because it was like she had broken up with someone to be with me. They had been together for a very long time, like 10 years. Mm. She felt bad about that. I felt bad about that. We were both quite sensitive people, so we both felt really bad about her ex-boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so it was just... And then she wasn't sure, maybe she should get back with him, but being quite open with me about that. So I'm like, always like, well, I could be ditched any second. And then it did like last a very short amount of time, like 3 months. Then she got back with him, and she was with him for 10 years before me. She's still with him now. So that was when I was 20. Wow. So like, you know, they were definitely the right couple, but like, they were just short, intense kind of thing. And because like that was the first time I ever said I loved someone.
Yeah.
So that's what I attached to what love was.
Of course, yes.
So that was like for fucking over a decade of like, well, that's what it is. That's what I'm in love with someone is, when I feel like that. And then like, you know, now being with someone who just like doesn't make me feel like that at all, it makes me feel a completely new thing that I'm like, oh, this is like,
yeah,
this is so much better. Yeah. Like, I can be myself around them. I don't feel like I'm having to at any point think about how am I acting? Should I behave like this? Maneuvering it. But like, but again, it's that thing of like, I guess when we're talking about men's mental health, a lot of the time, you know, square one, you know, right at the beginning, if you want to start the conversation, is just talking about, be open about your emotions, know what they are.
Yes.
And be able to label them properly. And go like, I feel like this. Because that's the thing, we've had to call it mental health, to get men talking about it, because we won't talk about feelings and emotions. Like, women have had it nailed for years because they openly go, how are you feeling? And talk about it. And I'm not saying, like, obviously there's loads of women, like, mental health is an issue for women as well. And there's loads of women who don't talk about those things. But generally speaking, the reason why it's made such a big issue for men and people talk about, you know, about men's mental health so much is because we just haven't, we won't go, how are you feeling? Are you feeling okay?
Yeah, but how are you really feeling?
You're a bit emotional. Like for years, being emotional was used against me.
Of course, criticism.
You're oversensitive. You're too emotional. Yeah. That all the time, like, right, I better not be that.
And by people who
were, you know, sometimes by, you know, I was in relationships and my girlfriend would say that to me about stuff that she would act the same way. But I go, but you would behave like this in this situation. And so am I being oversensitive? Oh, for a man I am, I guess. Because like, well, you would behave this way, so you can't think it's oversensitive because you do it as well. And it was like, yeah, you're not meant to behave like that.
No.
And so like, yeah, because we won't talk about emotions because we think that's bad. We won't talk about feelings because that's bad. So they've had to rebrand it and go, it's mental health. Go,
mental.
Our brains are saying, I'm pretty clever. I'll get into my mental. I like puzzles.
The brain gym.
I talk about mental health, sure. It's a serious game. It's not like light stuff, like emotions and feelings.
We better label it for so men. So it's more palatable.
Yeah.
Your next episode is a podcast for people bursting into their 40s, 50s and beyond.
Talking to people like Laura Dodsworth.
One thing I didn't consider at all with manhood until I'm in my first shoot and I thought, what the fuck am I doing? I was on my knees in front of a man I don't know at all photographing his penis. I thought, oh, I'm going to be doing this 100 times.
And people like Sober Dave.
When you give up drinking, you feel everything. You know, all your emotions come out before you'd numb them before. So all of a sudden it's like, what is this? How am I going to deal with this? Mm. You know, before it'd be, I'd just get drunk and it'd go away.
I'm Amy.
I'm Louise.
Join us for your next episode.
By your favourite podcast app.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I thought I wasn't anxious because I had a friend who, you know, had an anxiety disorder. Yeah. And he, you know, wonderful man, but he couldn't leave the house and stuff. So I was that's what anxiety is.
Yes.
Is you can't leave your house and you obsess over, you know, things that you've said to people all the time. And it really is, you know... It's that kind of like extreme. So I was like, I'm not anxious.
No.
Because like that's what...
I'll just not the shops.
Yeah, you don't see it as that. And like, yeah, I remember when I was in... I went to... I did like a really crappy music course at this college in Northampton. And before we did our first gig, the whole point was form a band. And the teacher told us like, you know, some of you might think you feel nervous before this gig. Some of you might feel excited. Just so you know, they're the same emotion. It just depends how you look at it, if you're positive or negative or not. So at the time I went, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So then every time I felt like that before a gig, I'd tell myself, I'm excited. Because I would turn my thing into a positive.
Yeah.
I'm excited. But actually, I wasn't. I was nervous and I was anxious. But I was telling myself, so I was mislabeling it, saying, you're excited now. But still the emotions were still doing what they do to you. And like, it's only really now, you know, I mean, that was like 2002.
Yeah.
So like, you know, now in like 2019 that I've actually thought to my, I was about to go on at a gig the other day and was feeling like that and going, oh, do you know what? You're anxious and you've been anxious every week, like multiple times a week before going on stage for like over 15 years. Like, and you're like, oh, what a thing to put your body through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Single, on this tour, I'm on a tour at the minute and like I'm doing two halves. And so I feel like it before going in the first half and I feel like it before in the second half. And it's like an hour each half, which is the most I've ever done. And so like in the interval, I'm like not just feeling anxious about going back on, but I'm feeling tired as well.
Yes.
Because it's a personal show and it is like a show that's talking about my mental health, which I've never done before. So I am kind of sitting there like, oh God, I've got to go back on. I've got to tell them all this stuff.
You've got to dig deep.
And all the anxiety. But like at least now I'm going, I'm nervous and that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than going, I'm excited. I'm walking around like a madman. I'm really excited about this gig. I'm like, no, you're not. Yeah, yeah. I'm in love with this audience. I think I'm in love with them all. You know, like.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, I think James needs to lie down. This show been more emotional than the others that you've done.
Mm.
Are you enjoying it though?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
When it goes well, it's the most I've enjoyed comedy.
Yeah.
When it doesn't go well, it's probably the least I've enjoyed comedy.
Yeah.
And I would say that in general, it is tiring and exhausting, and more tiring and exhausting than anything else I've done. I would be very, very surprised. I mean, next year I'm pretty much taking a year off of doing live stand-up anyway. And that's not just because of this tour, it's because of like 11 years of doing comedy.
We've had a load of stuff.
And not ever having a break from live work. So like, you know, it's recognising that I need some time off anyway. But definitely this show, even if like on this tour, I can have a great first half. And in the first half, I don't really, you know, I talk about mental health for like a little bit.
Yeah.
But not, most of the first half is not about that. So there's one little bit in there as a kind of like, so I don't know, kind of prepares them a little bit for the second half so it doesn't come out of nowhere. But I could have an amazing first half and it goes like exactly how I wanted it to. And in the interval, I'm still thinking, I don't want to go back on.
Yeah, really?
So like, because I am a bit like, when I did, I did a few London runs before doing the tour in, it was October last year, November, and then January and February, like a week long run each. And I remember in the January one, okay, into the Thursday, I think, so the fourth night, I'm thinking, and they'd all gone well, and I'd been really proud of each night, and I'm about to go on at the fourth one and going, oh, I don't know if I want to tell them all this personal stuff again, and then being really worried and being like, oh, actually, you've got to do a whole year, because I knew that I had a really long tour, the longest tour I've ever done ahead of me, that was like going from March to December, just like with August off, but like otherwise pretty much the most nights I'm gigging doing this show. And I was like, fuck, if you feel like this after four, this is like what are you gonna do when you've got a like when you're a few months in and you've got this. And like, you know, there's been nights where I've completely because the start of it is me going on in that outfit you described in the shades and the sunset jacket and like,
because you DJ at the beginning of it.
Oh, I used to, and I had to stop that.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
I used to be on stage when they came in the shades and stuff, and I'd have an iPod, and there'd be tracks playing, and then I'd always stop it and play this one song really loud, and kept on playing the same song over and over again, and staring the audience down. And I really enjoyed doing that. But then, the more I did it, the more people started just coming up to me while I was on stage, like, James, get a selfie before the show. Come here. And I'd be in character.
They don't get it, yeah.
So I'd ignore them. And then, but I'd ignore them because I was like being this kind of like, you know, straight-faced, emotionless guy playing his songs. And instead of laughing at it and thinking that's funny, they'd go, oh, well, fuck you then. And then sit down and you'd be like I can't put up with this before the show.
No.
Like, before the show, having someone genuinely angry at me and telling me, like there was one gig I had to literally stop the music and go, because one guy wouldn't stop heckling me.
Yeah.
And I had to stop the music and deal with him before the show. I was like, Joe, what? This is not setting the tone.
God.
So it's a real shame. But I'm doing some in London at the end of this tour. And I'm going to film them as well.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do that again.
Brilliant.
Doing that, because I'd like to get that on film. So I really liked doing that. Because it made it, I mean, it was more intense because I'd be on in the interval.
Yeah.
So it meant I'd go on in the first half, did an hour, then I'd be on stage for 20, 25 minutes in the interval.
Oh, wow.
And then another hour again. So it's like an hour and a half, two and a half hours,
yeah,
essentially.
Solid.
Just being on stage for the whole thing.
Holy shit.
But I found that really, like, you know, because of the subjects I was talking about, it really went with the theme of the show. It really made the show like more. Because I'm talking about the worst year of my life, and when,
yes,
it felt like things were just relentless. So it's good that it feels like you've got no respite from it.
Yeah.
And the whole show is just one thing that won't go away. And it's like, if you want to talk about mental health, it's not like, I'll just bench that for a bit and then, yeah, pick it up again. It's like, no, it's constant.
It's constant,
it's
yeah.
So, but yeah, but the ones that have gone, yeah, the ones that have gone badly, like when I go on, I've got the shades on at the top and I do a whole thing about, like, you know, I'm cool now and I hate my audience and all this,
right,
kind of stuff. And crowds who have seen me over the years and know what I do, it's a really fun beginning to the show, and they know that it's not a face value. But I still, you know, we're always going to get people who haven't seen us before, or places that you've never been on tour in that particular place and they're less familiar with you. And doing those ones and going on and doing that bit and them taking it a bit more at face value.
Yeah.
Really takes the wind out my sails early doors, because I think, oh, I'm staring down the barrel of like 2 hours now in front of these people, and
he's livid, and he's,
yeah, and I've got to really try and not drive it into a ditch. I've got to be like, just get to the interval,
yeah,
and if you don't acknowledge how it's going by the interval, you're gonna feel better. And I know that logically,
yeah,
I know logically, if you get to the interval and you haven't said, this is going shit, you're shit, I'm shit, or whatever,
yeah,
then you'll be relieved in the interval. And when you get to the interval, if you've done that, then you'll be able to do the second half.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're fine. But still, you know, I've been doing this since I was an open spot, fucking gigs up, by going like, oh, you don't like this.
Oh, man.
And
yeah,
feeling all that,
yeah,
insecurity.
Yeah.
And insecure, but also like, you know, you feel angry on stage. At like, why do you not like it? And all this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It gets even more when you're like, I've built my own audience now. You still don't like this. and like, you know, the amount of times I'm sat there in the interval. Just last week, I was in the interval going like, what the fuck are you doing, man? You know, right, not to do that.
Yeah, yeah,
you've,
yeah,
learned a million times. Don't throw it back in their face and tell them they're a shit,
yeah,
audience. Like, you know not to do it, and you've done it again. And now you've got to go back on and do an hour. And in this next hour, you've got to tell them that you had suicidal thoughts. You've got to tell them all this stuff. And you don't want to tell them that now.
No.
Because you just made enemies of them instead of like a group of, you know, if you didn't do any of that shit and they were just quiet, you'd come off and you'd be like, ah, good that I didn't have a go at them. They're quiet, but do you know what? They're probably,
yeah, yeah,
still,
yeah,
enjoying it. Or, you know, that means that this is probably the audience that needs to hear this, you know, what you're talking about, even more. So like, you know, because then you're not preaching to the choir.
Yes.
So like, so good. So you just go out there and do the show and don't worry about them being quiet. It doesn't mean they're not enjoying it. It doesn't mean they're not engaged with it. It doesn't mean they're not thinking about it. But if I'm in the interval thinking, you fucked that, I'm just like, it's, and it is that thing of,
yeah,
going like, why? I mean, you know, it comes down to tiredness. You know, I'm too tired, and when I'm too tired, I get stressed,
mm-hmm,
and I get more anxious or depressed more easily. So I'm knackered, and then doing stand-up is insane.
It doesn't make any sense when you really look at it.
Everyone who tells us, I couldn't do what you do, what do you do if they don't laugh? What do you do if they heckle and all this? And we all act like for years, I was such a bullshitter.
Yeah.
When they go like, what do you do if they don't laugh? I go, that's all right, yeah, don't laugh, they don't laugh. It's up to them. What do you do if someone heckles? So I just fucking deal with it. I judge it on its own individual merit, it's fine.
Yeah.
What do you do if you don't feel like being funny that day? It's my job, I've got to do it. And it's actually bollocks. All those things that people who don't do stand-up are afraid of and would worry them, and the reasons they don't do it, all of those things affect me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm affected by audiences not laughing.
Of course.
I'm affected by someone heckling me.
Yeah.
I'm affected by being too tired to do the gig. Like, all of it affects me.
Yeah.
And most nights I am going, yeah, I'm not superhuman. I'm exactly like everyone else in this room, except I wrote some material.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I wrote some material, I worked on it and did gigs, but I'm exactly the same as you guys are, I'm fragile. Yeah. I can't really deal with a lot of the judgment that comes with this job.
I've never felt like I fitted in.
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting in front of you saying, no, I'm fine. But really, I'm like, oh, I just want to fit in.
It's
madness. It is madness.
I want to be accepted by you all.
But at the same time, I want to be in front of you.
Yeah.
Doing this to you.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. I've done that before at a gig. I remember being on stage and suddenly I just thought about it. Mm. I just went, why are you doing this in my head? Yeah. And then suddenly the audience, they all sort of felt really far away.
Mm.
And I just, oh, no. And then I could hear myself talking.
Yeah.
And, oh, God. Oh, no. I've done it. I've taken the lid off.
Yeah.
I was fine before.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've had so many ones where I've articulated that on stage, and I had a gig in Brisbane, and it's the most tired I've ever been before a gig. Like I'd done 2 weeks in America, where I'd been flying to a different place every single day,
bloody hell,
and by myself without a tour manager, and doing two shows a night that were an hour and a half each without an interval each, so it's 3 hours of comedy a night.
Jesus,
and I've done that, and then gone straight to the Melbourne Festival. And done my show every day, sometimes twice a day, for 2 weeks there. Obviously, incredibly lucky to be able to do all that.
Yeah.
But by the end of those 4 weeks, I was exhausted.
Physically
and mentally exhausted. And I needed a break. But instead, I'd book myself in this little, couple of gigs in Sydney, Perth, Brisbane, before going to New Zealand. So, I was... I went to Brisbane... I think it was the last one of those three. So I'd done Perth, I'd done Sydney. I was already kind of starting to come apart.
Yeah.
Because again, your time zones start changing again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they don't realise how much that fucks you up.
Absolutely fucks you up. Yeah. I got to Brisbane. I remember getting to a hotel at Brisbane and just immediately, one of the few times in my life where I've just sat down and immediately fell asleep. And then got woken up to go to the gig. And was so tired, and I went on, and they were just a very reserved audience.
Oh, wow.
And so, I didn't have any energy, and they didn't have any energy.
Ugh.
And so, instead of just doing the gig, I started referencing, they weren't laughing much. Because in Melbourne, it kind of become a part of the show.
Yes.
That I was having a go at the audience, but it's because I understand the Melbourne audience a bit more, that they're, very right on, and they like to show that they're on the right side of every issue. So if I did a routine that was a bit right on, instead of showing that they agreed with me by laughing, they would show that they agreed with me by being silent and nodding and going yes. And so it was a funny thing throughout the show to lay into them for that, and it kind of worked with the themes of the show of rejection and stuff like that, and me rejecting the audience and my relationship with the audience. So I thought by the time I got to Brisbane, that's part of the show now, is that you dig at the audience. And then I had a dig at them, and they absolutely were not having any of it. And were really surprised, and being we thought we were laughing. We thought we liked this show. And then eventually it was they're not laughing at the show very loud. They're laughing at this stuff even less. And now I've got nothing. And so I kind of at one point kind of completely just became a normal person on stage and went, okay, well, look, I was only doing all that stuff, having a go at you, because normally that's my plan B.
Oh, wow.
And
deconstruction.
I was only doing that but that's not working, so I don't really know where I go from here. I'm fucking knackered. And I kind of shared too much with them, really told them about just why it wasn't going. I was okay, well, this is fucked, and I guess this is pretty awkward now, and I don't really know how to get out of this and all this. And then people were concerned afterwards. People were contacting my dad on Twitter saying really worried about your son. People contacted Stuart Goldsmith on the Comedian Facebook group saying you want to check in on him. A Reddit thread started about the one gig, just being who was at that gig the other night, who else is concerned about him. And really, it was just I was absolutely exhausted and shouldn't have been doing a gig. I should have been having a day off. That was all it was. My job involves having to talk for an hour.
Yes.
Some people, if they're feeling like that at work, can just get their head down, sit behind their desk. I just won't do much work today, but I don't have to speak to people out loud about what's going on in my head all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm having to try and make them laugh, and sometimes part of making them laugh is being real with them and going, well, if I go this way, I might find an observation that we all relate to, and then you don't. And you feel even more alienated, I'm the only person who feels like this, so I'm a weirdo now, and they all think I'm weird. And then you get defensive.
Yeah.
But what I realised, I was in a therapy session the other day, and I was talking about needing approval as a kid and needing a, kind of validation from adults as a kid. And I remembered that there was this this video of myself, you know, home video, and there's some family friends are over called Julian and Karen, a couple who are friends with my parents. And there's a video of me going over and showing this drawing that I've done. I used to do loads of drawings as a kid and showing it to this guy, Julian, and being like that. And he was like, oh, that's so good. Wow, James, that's really clever. And me just like looking up at him, like really like, you know, feeding off of it. And yeah, like, he likes the drawing. I don't think he's and like all this. And in Brisbane, they were at that gig. That couple had moved to Australia, and I hadn't seen them since I was a kid. And they had contacted me and been like, can we come and see you tonight? And I got them tickets. And then on stage, all I was thinking was, they're not like those two. I didn't put it together in my head until I was talking in the therapy session. He was like, is there any, like, you know, because we're talking about needing validation as a kid and showing adults like drawings or putting plays on and all that. And I remembered that video. I was like, oh, fuck, that was him. And they were like people in my childhood. I definitely did that with all the time. Like every time they came over, I would have showed them drawings going, this is good. Do you think this is good?
Yeah.
And then I'm an adult and they're coming to see me do stand-up for the first time. They haven't seen me since I was in primary school. and I'm like, want to show them that it's great. And then when it goes badly, for some reason, I go into this deeper pit of despair than I usually would. And I don't know why at the time. And then now I'm like, it's because
of that.
Because that's who they are to you.
They're
these people that you want them to give you a pat on the head and go, well done, James, we're proud of you, you're doing well. and now you fucked it. Like on stage, like they're not going to say this to you now. They're going to think that you're not on the right track with comedy. And, you know.
But you've done so many good things and had so many good gigs and have been so successful that things like that now probably... You're able to go, oh, like you've just said, I just needed a night off.
Yeah.
Where at the time it's probably more intense than that, but now you can sort of look back and go, yeah, I haven't fucked my career.
Mm.
I just got to take some time out when I get like that. I've learned a valuable lesson.
I'm able to give myself to know how to deal with it. So having a year off next year, which might become 2 years off. I'm not putting any kind of like time limit on it, but like I wouldn't have been able to do that before because I would have felt like, I can't afford to take time. I need to be constantly on it. And not even thinking of afford as in money-wise, although that definitely was the case as well, but like thinking of it in terms of like just reputation-wise. Like I need to continue doing stand-up and keeping everyone's heads, otherwise they'll forget about me and I won't be able to keep doing stand-up anymore. And I want to do this as a job, so I want people to see it. Whereas now I am a little bit more like, oh, do you know what? The things that I've done that I am proud of, because I would still probably... look back and say that I have enjoyed less gigs than I haven't enjoyed.
Right.
And that's like a shame. But like, I would say like less gigs than, and also that the lows I feel after a bad gig, I very rarely feel the equivalent in highs after a good gig.
Okay.
I'd say once recently I did, and it was insane what it did to me. Like I had the best gig this show's ever gone. And for 24 hours afterwards until I had to do my next gig, I was high as a kite, just properly so happy. We haven't been like that probably since I was an open spot, and I felt like, you know, actually maybe like every show I've done, I've had like one gig that's been like that. That's exactly how I wanted it to go, and that's exactly how it's always been in my head. And then you come off really on a high that I did it. I made the thing I wanted to make. But normally, if I have a good gig, I feel relieved. Relieved it didn't go badly.
Right.
And when it goes bad, I feel utter like, not only should I quit and that I'm not good at this, and and it's not good for my mental health either, like it keeps doing this to me, so why am I doing it? But also I'll be like, and what do I do after this? I don't know what else to do. Oh fuck, life is so fucking long, and I don't know how to fill it. I don't know what my like calling is in life. I'm not be good at anything. I'm just gonna start something else. I'll just find a whole bunch of new problems with that. Completely catastrophizing and depressed and after a bad gig. Whereas like after a good one, I'm never, you know, I'm hardly ever like, oh, I'm the king of the world, this is great, and like the opposite. So looking back, you know, but now on the positive side, I have got enough things that I'm proud of that I'm like, do you know what, if I take some time off and, you know, that's for whatever reason eventually means that I fall out of favour, I can't go back to stand-up or whatever. If the worst happened, I can deal with it because like, I'm happy with what I've done.
Yeah,
What I've done is enough for me now. I think really wanted to do since day one. I didn't realise until I did it was film some shows.
Right.
So it's like, I've filmed shows, I've got them, I can watch them back. I've only watched them back once, but like, I watched them back and was like, that's what I want those shows to be like. And so I was like, great. And after that, I just felt like, I've done it. I've done what I wanted to do. I've been very lucky, you know, being able to do the books as well. I grew up reading like Dave Gorman books and stuff like that, and wanted to write those kind of books and be like, and like, so I feel very lucky to have achieved that. And yeah, and then there's been other things that have been, yeah, I think those two things, the books and the specials and the podcast with Ed, are other things where I'm like, yeah, that's what you wanted.
Yeah.
You wanted to do them. You've achieved that. And so now just like go a bit more easy on yourself
and
move away from it. And then you can look at all the bad gigs you've had, all the gigs that felt bad, and kind of be a little bit more like, you're having a bad time.
Yeah,
like, you're having a bad time, and you're not insane, and most people wouldn't even get on that stage.
No, exactly. Like, especially with, like you say, the turmoil that was going on in the behind the scenes, especially the stuff you talk about in this latest show.
Yeah.
You know, we won't go into details now so people can see it, but the one thing, when we had dinner that time and you were telling us about it, and you were saying how, I mean, it's going to give it away a little bit, but you said how Mr. Bean is everywhere.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Since you said it, he's fucking everywhere.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. Like, there's dolls, there's toys, there's there's that. He's in every single shop. So you got that going on.
Well, that's thankfully the lighter part of the show.
Yeah.
So that's like, not so much of a... That's the thing in the show that... I don't know when this podcast will go out, but like... I'd say that I tell one lie in the show.
Yeah.
And that's that I tell them that everything I talk about on stage, I've dealt with it and I've processed it and it's fine. And that's not true.
Right.
So that bit is true. That bit, I've dealt with it years ago. It's fine. It's just funny to me. It's fine. But there's, you know, there's three other big stories in that show that, you know, I can talk to people about, but they still trigger emotions and still make me feel shit. And that's definitely something I won't do again.
No.
Is talk about something too early.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, I did it because it wasn't planned. I didn't plan to do this show. I after the specials went out, I was worried that I wouldn't have anything. I wouldn't be able to write something else after that. So I just thought it's really important that you just do a show now and that you get a show done. And you don't get in your own head about following these specials that, you know, to other people, they're specials that they like, sure, but you're making a bigger deal of them in your head than they are.
Definitely.
You're seeing them as these like grand achievements. but like actually everyone else says, oh yeah, that guy did some specials once, and actually following them up isn't such a big deal, and you need to just follow them up so that you don't you know, make it bigger than it is in your head. So I was just like, right, book loads of work in progress and do some gigs.
Yeah.
Come up with a new show. And on stage, I was trying to do the old stuff I used to do. I used to like pretend that I was an undercover cop while I was in witness protection and have a big ruse that was silly and whimsical.
That's it. We're trying to find... And, were you trying to kiss Yoko Ono in one of them?
Yeah, one of them. I was defending Yoko Ono for the whole thing, trying to kind of stand up for Yoko Ono.
That was it.
And, but, you know, I just found in those shows, in those work in progress shows, that didn't work anymore. People were a bit like... oh, okay, he's kind of doing that. And my heart wasn't in it, and it was like, and then I just started, you know, thinking, work in progress, to do whatever you like, it doesn't matter. When I was an open spot, Josie Long told me to just try any idea you've got when you're an open spot, because no one can judge you. And I always see, like, working on a new show, work in progress, that you're an open spot again. So you try everything again, and they can't judge you. If they do, who cares? Like, they're idiots. If they're judging a work in progress, it's not for them.
No.
Work in progress is just for me. So I started going, I'm just going to tell them about this personal stuff and see what happens. And I thought, like, oh, maybe down the line, you know, I'll figure out a metaphor to do that isn't, that I don't have to talk to them about.
Yeah.
I'll figure out a ruse, like, I'm in prison or something, you know, or something like that. But nothing worked as well. I was even trying to ditch, so there's a big routine in the show about being dropped by my agent. And I tried to get rid of that and not do it in the show multiple times.
Really?
I'd do it at work in progress gigs and it'd go really well one night and would feel like the most important routine I'd ever done. And then the next night it wouldn't work and I'd feel very alone and judged. And then you know, the next night it'd be a disaster.
Yeah.
I've had two people in work in progress shows cry during that bit.
Bloody hell.
And stuff like that, because I got it wrong. I got the tone of, you know, people have been talking. I think a guy was talking during it, and I was like, what are you talking about? Because it's like, you know, work in progress. So I'll go into the audience more. What are you talking about? And he's like, it just reminded me of something that happened. And then crying out. The show ended with me hugging this guy on stage as he cried and everyone leaving. And I remember thinking, I can't have gigs turn into this.
No.
It can't be. I can't be responsible for this.
No.
Like, it's not fair on this guy. It's not, you know. So, like, a lot of missteps along the way of being like, this is not what I want this to be. And trying to get rid of it and trying to not do that routine. And then, like, I remember doing a work in progress when I didn't have it in. It went badly. And the audience member said, I saw you do a gig with that in it, and it was the best show I've seen you do. And I was like, fuck, he's right. I should put it in there. But now it's in there, it does, you know, take its toll on me. So, like, you know, if I'm honest about it, you know, I'm not necessarily ready to be talking about all this stuff to strangers.
No.
And so it's a lesson learned, really. It's not that I'm not proud of the show.
No.
But I definitely, you know, look at it and go, do you know what? This, and this, you probably aren't completely ready to talk to audiences about it.
No.
There are some bits where, like, if I mention going to therapy on stage, there's always a few people in the room will laugh. And there's not a joke there.
No, right.
I just mention going to therapy and a few people will giggle. And the thing is that those people could be giggling because they go to therapy.
Yeah.
And I've just said, you know, about, you know, being told by my girlfriend you should go to therapy again, and they laugh because maybe they've been in that position as well, where they've gone to therapy, they've stopped going to therapy, they're going through a tough time, and someone tells them they should go again, and and they go, oh yeah, I know what that's like when someone calls you on that. But several times on stage, I've kind of gone into things of like, oh, that's funny, is it? Like, almost not singled them out, but kind of going, yeah, some people will laugh at that because therapy to them is funny, and I've kind of almost been on my high horse and been like, but you know what? If you think therapy is funny, this show's pretty much for you if you think that and all this. But actually, in that situation, I'm not really saying to them, I'm probably not talking to someone who's not ready to talk about therapy and is laughing about it immaturely. I'm probably talking to someone who is ready to talk about it, has done it, is able to laugh at their own life experience, because that's what stand-up is a lot of the time. And then I'm saying to them, you don't get it. And they're like, and they're probably not sitting there going, oh dear, he's misunderstood me. They're there going, you don't get it, mate. Like, I don't think you're right. I don't think you're ready to talk about this. Yeah, so it's kind of that a little bit more. I'm still insecure about talking. I still feel like, oh, maybe they're all judging me and they'll think I'm stupid because I went to therapy, or maybe they think this, that, and the other. Maybe they think I'm weird. And sometimes I have got, you know, just unarguably aggressive or immature heckles when I'm talking about mental health on stage. I have, you know, told the audience I had suicidal thoughts, and had audience members shout out, oh, poor little baby, like that. This guy shouted that out.
Wow.
In Sheffield.
Shit.
And I had to just, like, and then the whole room kind of, like, just completely silent after you said it. But I've had a few like that, a few heckles that have been like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Well, I suppose people, because people see you, you're James Acaster.
Sure.
And they see James, the successful James Acaster. I had Rob Beckett on, and Rob Beckett comes up a lot on this. Because when I interviewed him, and he said that he's still, you know, he's Rob Beckett and he's on all these shows. Yeah. He didn't say that. I was like, well, you look like you're having a great time. But he's like, sometimes he's lying in bed and he's like, what's the fucking point?
Sure.
He still feels sad. He feels shit because he's a human being. And that's the same with you. So you had such a traumatic thing you were going through. You were just like, I'm just going to fucking end it.
Yeah, sure.
And
it
doesn't matter how many shows you've done or what successes you've had. Underneath it all, you're a human being.
Yeah, it's still the same. Also, last week, like, I don't really see Beckett that much.
No.
I don't think we've ever, like, properly hung out one-on-one before. But, like, I always get on with him when I see him. And I definitely have that. Even though I know who I... You know, I know that with me, you know, audiences or whatever might see me as one thing, and I know that that's not who I am. I know I'm a person. But I can still look at other people. I look at Beckett and think, like, he's got it sorted.
Yeah, exactly.
Beckett's fine. Beckett won't care if, like, the audience aren't laughing that much, because he's comfortable enough in himself. And he's like, you know, he's going on getting the job done.
So if they're not laughing,
who cares? And the other night, I was like, I had a gig and I was like, just feeling shit before even going on. And Beckett rang me up out of nowhere. And I answered it, and he was like, about to do a venue that I'd done. And he was like, what's this venue like? And all that. And I just told him. and we had a chat, and he basically feels exactly the same as I do. Like, and it was such a weird thing where, like, it was so good of him, really. He probably won't know how much I needed that phone call. He kind of phoned up and just said, like, you know, basically that he was, before I could even say any of it, I didn't say to him, here's how I'm feeling about gigs.
Mm.
He was like, how's your tour going? And I was like, yeah, it's all right, you know, up and down, and how's yours? I went, yeah, good. You know, obviously sometimes, you know, don't laugh much, and you just want to tell them about their ideas up, and you just think, fucking hell. Because it's a gruel then. And he said to me, you know, if you ever want to ring me up at any point, because, like, you know, there's only like me and you and a couple of other people at the minute who are doing these kind of gigs where, like, we've just started doing these rooms.
Yeah.
And, like, so we understand what it's like, and we're touring it right now. And if you ever want to give me a ring and chat about it, then go for it. And after, like, this is someone who, like, I kind of naively and ignorantly kind of thought, like, almost like when I would come off after having had a go at them, he would be the kind of comedian I'd think about and go, he wouldn't do this. why am I such an idiot? Something's wrong with me. I can't do this. There are more professional comics out there like Rob Beckett who wouldn't do it. And he was like, yeah, the other day I had a bit of a go at the Northampton crowd and I felt bad about it. And I was like, oh, like, fucking hell, okay, like, yeah, we're people and that's what happens. And, like, saying, it was like, you know, just, you know, give us something. And basically giving someone a ring is doing the exact same thing as you, no matter what it is, what job you're working in, whatever, and just going, like, oh, this person's, you know, in the same job as me, maybe at the same level that I'm at now.
Yeah.
Understand, because also, like, once people have gone past that level, they don't understand either.
No.
You know, you get an open spot, ring up a comic who's, like, employed in doing the circuit with their problems, they go, just get through it. Even though when they were an open spot, they were like, It's like how we all honk at learner drivers and get fucking behind a learner, what the fuck is your problem? Even though we were a learner once.
Yeah.
But we just never, you know, but, like, yeah, anyway, but, like, it was just good to, like, have someone going, like, I'm in the same position as you, and I do feel the same way, so you're not crazy.
It's a nice feeling, isn't it? To know that.
Yeah. When people are in this position, this is how they feel.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, great.
Lovely.
And it's just like...
Yeah.
Yeah. So I should have said thank you to him on the phone. I think I did.
You know, we'll tag him in this.
I think I said thanks to him on the phone. If I didn't, thank you, Rob.
James, this has been lovely.
Thank you so much.
And you're off on tour now, aren't you? Today, this minute.
I'm going off to... Where am I tonight? Sheffield, I think.
Off to Sheffield. So
another heckle about being a wimp, I imagine.
I've got a lot of time for Sheffield.
I love Sheffield. I'm actually, like, I probably shouldn't say this in a podcast, but I was doing a thing with some other comics on a text group recently of saying, like, next time I go on tour, I'm going to do 10 venues. And just being like, and listed the 10, and Sheffield is, and this week I've got, like, an absolute treat of Sheffield, Leeds and Manchester.
Oh, nice.
Salford, respectively. But, like, they're three of the 10, so, like, potentially this is the best week of the tour, but we'll see. Mate. I've said that now, so.
I'm going to have to do a follow up now, do a phone call. How'd you get on? Fucking,
I want to quit. You should get me after one of those gigs. I always think that. I don't know about, like, people who go to therapy sessions, but, like, every time I come off a gig and I'm completely depressed and I want to quit and I'm thinking all those things, I go, now I want to go into a therapy.
Yeah.
Put me in now. Put me into a therapy session now and we'll actually get to the, because now I'm covered in all the grime.
Right.
It's actually, by the time I get to my next therapy session, it'll have all kind of, like, washed off a little bit and I'll be more coherent. But actually, like this podcast, really, probably the best time would have been after I've had a rubbish gig, straight off stage into the green room, have you there and be like, right, here's my mental health. Here's how it actually is.
That's where I'm at now.
Yeah. And, like,
maybe we'd do that.
Yeah, you should just pick a comic like me who's just, like, not too tightly wrapped, a bit on the edge, and do a whole tour with them until they have that first bad gig, and then get it in the can. See
you later, James. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
You can get loads of likes.
It'd be way more helpful for people at home.
James, thanks, mate.
Thanks, man.
Appreciate
Cheers.
That.
Thank you.
Lovely.
Cheers, Rich.
Thank you so much for coming down. Really appreciate it. Insane in the Membrane podcast.
Insane in the Membrane is back for another live podcast recording on Sunday, the 23rd of February.
I found that through humour, people open up and we have a laugh. And I really appreciate you coming down and doing this.
This is an intimate live show with comedian Rich Wilson and very special surprise guest in front of a small audience at the Pleasance Islington. In fact, you are so close to the comedians, you could probably lick them.
We can have a laugh while we do it. I think that's what I'm trying to show with the podcast.
January's a struggle for us all, so put yourself something to look forward to in February. Insane in the Membrane live at the Pleasance. Sunday, Feb 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Just £5. Nearest tube, Caledonian Road, Piccadilly Line, dead easy, no excuses.
You did great, Rich.
Thanks, Bob. You
did
as well.
You great.
Thank you.
Click the link in the show description for this episode on your podcast app or go to pleasants.co.uk.
What do we do now?
I don't know. I think that's it. Thanks for coming. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And check back here for the next episode of Insane in the Membrane, released every Thursday night at 6.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.